One thing is sure, we are all going to die. But how we will die is an unknown. Or is it? You may not have thought about it before, but you can have some control over how you will die. That is, if you plan ahead. Stay with us as we talk about advanced directives or living wills. Go Healthy for Good starts right now. I'm Dr. Nerida. Welcome to Go Healthy for Good. On today's show, we're talking about planning ahead and making advanced directives. Why not let your nearest and dearest be aware of your wishes? Perhaps then there'll be fewer surprises, better communication and understanding, and a greater chance of maintaining dignity at the end of your life. Many of you are familiar with Dr. Clifford Goldstein, a prolific author and theologian. Here in the first segment, he tells about his relationship with his father and how it was impacted by illness.
Well, you know, my dad was always a very good father to me. He really was. As a kid, I had problems. We had moved when I was young, and I was very unhappy with the move and didn't adjust well to school. And my father was just a larger-than-life figure to me, and I loved his war stories. He had fought in World War II and had great war stories and so on. And I was very close to my father as a child. I mean, it was just, my dad meant everything to me. And then, you know, I got older and started doing things that I shouldn't have been doing. And so, you know, I remember my dad even one time said to me, he was a little worried that I was so close and so clingy to him that I was a little too old to be that way. He almost like he wanted me to back off. And then I did, you know, but I always, you know, had a good relationship with my dad. And then my parents got divorced when I was in college and my father remarried. Okay. And then it's, you know, when a man gets remarried, he forgets his children and, you know, he started a new life. And so there was some more of a distance there, you know, it's just natural that would happen. But we always got along, you know, we always got along very well. And I often tell people, my dad gave me something as a child, a sense of stability. I've often said, I can't put money value on it. He gave me a sense of stability, a sense of security. And I can remember when my kids were born, and I remember thinking what I got from my father, even though I can't put it in exact words, I thought, I'm going to try to even do more for my children and just to be there and a sense of security and so on. And that's something I'll take for the rest of my life. I'll have that for the rest of my life. You know, my dad, it's funny, my dad smoked for 74 years. He started to get, well, he was getting emphysema, which, you know, okay, 74 years smoking. And then he was also getting this retinal, this macular degeneration, and that's smoking, you know, smoking. And he was already blinded, going blind in one eye, and the other eye was bad. And I can still remember one day seeing him. This was a few years before he died, and he said, you know, by the way, I got some bad news with, you know, my eyes. It seems like the other eye's going. And he told me that right as I was leaving, and I remember just sitting in my car and just crying. You know, just the thought of my dad going blind. And my dad fought, I said, he fought in World War II, and he came back with the shakes. You know, he came back with the shakes, and then his hands always shook. And then as he got older, he got some kind of, they don't know what it was. I don't think they ever diagnosed, but his hands were just shaking and shaking, and it got to the point where he could barely feed himself, you know. And so he had macular disease. He was going blind. He had old age leukemia. It was just sort of, it was a kind of doctor said, oh, you'll outlive it, okay, but just, you know, it's leukemia, you know, and he said it was draining him of energy, you know, he was tired all the time, and I knew my dad was getting real older years ago when he sold his boat, you know, for my dad to sell his boat, Then he was into tennis. Then he stopped playing tennis. I mean, the guy was in his 70s playing tennis. And then he stopped riding his motorcycle, okay? Because I think the eyesight was issued. Then he was into playing pool. Well, then his hands were shaking so bad he couldn't play pool anymore. And then it got to the point where he was, and he was deaf. Very bad hearing. I have very bad hearing, too. I got it, honestly. My hearing's going bad. His father got bad hearing. He got it. And he said he fired a 50 caliber machine gun in the war. And he said that didn't do his hearing any good either. So in other words, he was just getting older and older. And the quality of life was getting worse and worse and worse. I remember one day he just said, I'm so tired of having to fight for everyday existence. And then later he apologized because my dad was not a whiner. You know, it was very hard to know. Every time I'd call him and say, how you doing? He'd say, fine. You know, and I knew it wasn't true. I knew it wasn't. And then you had the situation with his wife. You know, she had, her kidneys were failing. She had severe osteoporosis. She was starting, I think her mind wasn't, you know, as lucid. And she apparently was diagnosed with spinal cancer. So she was just sort of going down. They both were just elderly people who were getting sicker and sicker, and thus what happened next was something I was partly very shocked about and another part not totally shocked about.
When you've been so close, it's tough to realize that the future is now uncertain. Keep watching for the rest of the story. Joining us in the studio shortly will be two experts on the ethics surrounding death and dying. But first, the news. In the headlines today, advanced care planning, now online, changing attitudes regarding death, and gut microflora related to rheumatoid arthritis. A new website, prepareforyourcare.org, has been developed to help older adults make decisions and create an advanced care plan. Researchers in San Francisco designed the Prepare website to be easy to use and supportive of the process. A pilot study showed that after visiting the site, users began to communicate with those involved in their care and to make advanced care directives. But whether you use the site or not, remember it's good to be prepared. Legislation on euthanasia in Switzerland permits assisted suicide. The results of a study were recently published by a Swiss research group looking at attitudes towards hastened death in amyotrophic lateral sclerosis patients and their caregivers. The wish to hasten death was expressed more often by those experiencing depression, anxiety, loneliness, a perception of being a burden to others, and lower quality of life. Lower religiosity was also a contributing factor. It would seem that psychosocial support was a key influencer in the wish to hasten death. The inflammation that's characteristic of early stage rheumatoid arthritis has been linked to an altered pattern of gut microorganisms. A group of researchers from New York University has found that 75% of those with newly diagnosed rheumatoid arthritis have an overabundance of pro-inflammatory bacteria called P. coppery, compared with 20% in healthy controls. Further research is needed to tell us whether this is the cause, the effect, an association, or just an incidental finding. In the meantime, supporting good gut health is more than what it seems. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's health news. Joining us now in the studio is Dr. Anita Tarzian, a former hospice nurse with a doctorate in nursing. Anita specializes in bioethics and is affiliated with the University of Maryland School of Nursing and Law. And joining us remotely from California is Dr. Steve Harden, a physician and clinical ethicist. Steve is the Associate Director at the Center for Christian Bioethics in the VA Loma Linda healthcare system. I asked Anita to explain what a living will entails.
So a living will is the written document that expresses your wishes if you're at the end of your life. So typically it covers one of three conditions. Either you're in a terminal condition where you're dying from advanced disease, or you're in a vegetative state, what's called, where you're in an irreversible state of unconsciousness or another type of condition. It's called an end-stage condition. But basically, you're at the end of your life, and so this will tell the healthcare providers and your loved ones what's important to you at that time. So the living will...
Does it need to be written down and signed, or can verbal instructions to family also count?
Verbal instructions count. So the family, when they're making decisions, if you can't anymore, so you're unable to tell doctors or your healthcare providers what you want, the family really is charged with telling them what they think you would have want if you could speak. So any direction that you've given to your family throughout your life is helpful to them at that time. Now, sometimes families can feel burdened at that moment. It's usually often a moment of crisis where they feel like they're making these choices mm-hmm. to let you live or die. And so having it in a more formal document can help relieve that burden, I think.
Let's say a loved one is injured, they're in a coma, and based on scan results, doctors are predicting it's unlikely that they'll walk again or they may have severe brain damage. But they cannot be sure, and you are asked if you want to continue life support. Dr. Harden, how does a document deal with that kind of diagnostic uncertainty, or does it?
Well, that brings up one of the major problems with a living will or just a sort of static written document. It may or may not perfectly correlate with the clinical situation at hand. And while a document such as a living will or other kind of medical directive can be helpful, speaking now as a clinician, if I have a family member, a person who is sort of empowered to make a decision, that's going to be much more practically useful in trying to make a clinical decision.
So how do you go about making that decision? Any advice?
You're speaking for the family, how they make that decision?
Yes, correct.
Well, the whole push for advanced directives certainly reflects the reality that we were seeing more and more patients in clinical states that nobody wanted to be in, and yet there seemed to be no way to get out of that. And so the idea with advanced directives is to encourage patients and families to think about and talk about these kinds of issues long before you actually have to make the decision. So certainly when I'm counseling a patient as a physician, I will encourage them to sort of think about what their values are, discuss that with their families, loved ones, and I strongly encourage them to name a person or persons who can then make decisions and try to give that person some leeway. Because as we often know, we don't have a clear way to predict exactly how things are going to play out.
Sure. Now, a few months ago, a woman was declared brain dead after taking a lethal cocktail of medications. She spontaneously roused just before going to the operating room to become an organ donor. Now, subsequent review of the case suggested that the decision had been made a little prematurely before the drugs had actually cleared from her system. Dr. Tarzian, how reassuring can you be to us that that really is a rare circumstance?
That is exactly the situation that the people that deal with the organ transplant system to provide reassurance to the public that that's not happening fear. So there is a rigorous process for determining that someone is dead based on brain death criteria. So you could obviously be dead if you stop breathing and your heart stopped and they couldn't be revived. And the other way of determining that someone is dead is based on brain death criteria.
And obviously she slipped through that.
So net. If you're on certain types of barbiturates or other drugs, if you have, there are certain conditions that can mimic brain death and interfere with the diagnostics that are done to confirm that someone is brain dead. So
we'll come to that in a moment.
Yes.
Ever thought about making your own milk? Well, after the break, we'll teach you how.
Death is the only inescapable, unavoidable, sure thing. We are sentenced to die the day we're born.
Death is a debt we all must pay.
Some people are so afraid to die that they never begin to live.
Every man must do two things alone. He must do his own believing and his own dying.
Death is not a period, but a comma in the story of life.
He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away.
In the kitchen, we are going to make some milk. And you might say, why make milk? Well, there are different reasons that you might want to make your own milk. And joining me now is Naomi, and she's going to help me. Naomi, what are these on the table?
Almonds.
Almonds. So we're going to make some almond milk. And what we're going to need here is 3/4 cup of whole raw almonds, 3 cups of water, 2 tablespoons of honey or 8 dates softened in water, a large pinch of salt, and a drop of vanilla essence. So why don't you pour all of those things in here for me? So in goes the milk. This is so easy, and you might want to think about making your own milk, because if I say milk, you probably think about a dairy cow. But not everybody tolerates dairy, and so it's good to have some other versatile ways to make milk. And nut milk is lovely. So Naomi's going to throw those nuts in. Oh, are they splashing you? Yeah, we'll just keep doing it that way because they're not splashing me. All right, let's put some sweetener in. You don't realize, but in your cow's milk you have lactose. So we're going to replace that here with some honey. Oh, yummy honey. And you'll notice that this milk is probably going to look a little bit brown. But one way to avoid that is to use blanched almonds. You can blanch them. You can just soak them in hot water and the skins will come off as you soak them, and you'd have to squeeze them off individually. And then a little bit of salt, because that will always make it a little more flavorful. Well, that's it. We've got the milk. Now it's going to get very noisy. We're going to blend this on high for 2 minutes. And that's so that those nuts become so tiny that it tastes like smooth milk. All right, so we're gonna go on and do that now. So excuse us for 2 minutes. You ready to try a glass of cold milk? I am. Do you want to pass a glass over for me? There we go. We've got the straws in and everything. Considering we put brown honey and brown nuts in, we've got a very white milk, haven't we? One for you too. There we go. That was quick, inexpensive, and easy. Here we go, let's see, the taste test. You like that? It's a little bit chewy, because we didn't go for the full 2 minutes. But that, if you put that on your breakfast cereal, You wouldn't even notice those little bits. And if you blended it really well, they'd be all gone. You like the taste?
Mm-hmm.
Mmm. Very good. Well, thanks for coming on the show, Naomi. It's been great having you in the kitchen, and thank you for your help.
You're welcome.
Men, do you want to gain an extra 4 years while looking and feeling great? Researchers in Loma Linda, California found the answer. For men, thinner is better, particularly as you age. The Adventist Health Study looked at men aged 75 to 99 and found the thinner men lived about 4 years longer. A healthy weight, even past the seventh decade of life, made a difference. Maintaining a healthy weight for your entire life is another ageless advantage.
And now the second part of Cliff's story. His dad has an added challenge and begins to map out his end-of-life plans and to communicate them with family. There are important decisions to make. Keep watching.
My father had a couple times had talked about that. He was just didn't want to keep going and that he was going to could shoot himself. And he told me he had said he had talked with his wife a few times, and she said something about hiding his gun, and he said, well, there are other ways you can do this. And I knew it just wasn't idle talk. I just knew my father, and as I said, my dad wasn't a depressed person. He was a mathematician, very logical and rational. And then anyway, I get a call about a little over a year ago. My sister calls me up, and she says, are you sitting down? She says, Dad is dead. She said he shot Inez and then shot himself. And of course, you know, you're just going to be blown away on that. And I think what I was really blown away over and didn't expect was him shooting her, okay? If she would have called me and said, she would have said, Cliff, Dad killed himself. I mean, of course, it would have been devastating, but I wouldn't have been totally surprised. In fact, it was very interesting. Before all this happened, I would call him, and I was really kind of annoyed because I'd call him, and I had the feeling that he wasn't listening to anything I say, and he just was like, just, it was mechanical. And I realize now what was going on. He was already, he knew he had planned this a long time, okay? So he was already checking out. So at the time, I said to my wife, you know, I'm really annoyed. I call my dad. He's got nothing to say. There's 2 minutes of everything is very, okay, that's good, you know, boom, and whatever it was. Now I look back. But see, what I hadn't known was, and my sister and his wife's brother knew, they had both made a pact. She had made him promise that if he were to do this, he wouldn't leave her behind, because she was losing it too. I mean, she had spinal cancer. She had to get 85 years old, kidney dialysis, you know, really severe osteoporosis. Things were just as bad for her practically in her own way. So I didn't know about the pact. And then after I called her brother, you know, and I said, you know, I'm real, it's funny how sometimes you could have dialogue you just never imagine. I said, I'm real sorry my father shot your sister, you know. And he had said to me, he said, your father's a hero to us. He honored a pact that he made with his wife, you know. And so I felt better hearing that. You know, went down to the memorial service like 2 days later. The Jews don't waste time. You die, they put you in the ground, you know, but it's not, you know, it's boom, boom, boom. So we went down, and I didn't know how their family was going to feel. You know, my father, you know, shoots their mother and their sister, and yet they were they loved my father. I could tell that. They loved him, and so there was none of that there. And I felt, you know, very good about that, that there was any kind of resentment. But they made a pact, and he honored the pact. I feel better how hard that must have been. You know, I feel bad about how hard it must be, because I know my dad. My dad was not a negative, depressed person. You know, he just wasn't that way. He was always very, he used to love to quote this author, Kurt Vonnegut. And Vonnegut used to say somebody was good at life. And my dad, he had trials, he had struggles like everybody else, but he said, you know, I'm good at life. But as I said before, he was sick. He was getting sicker. There was no way he was going to get better. And he knew that, and she knew that, and so they had the pact. And so he shoots her and then shoots himself. And, you know, I feel bad, and I miss my father, and I...
How do you deal with a shock like that? We'll find out later in the program. There's a document online called The Five Wishes. It's been described as an advanced directive with a heart. The Five Wishes suggests appointing a healthcare agent, just as Dr. Steve Harden mentioned earlier in the show. I asked him to explain the purpose of it.
Well, the purpose of the healthcare agent is so that if I am the physician caring for the patient, I actually have somebody to talk to. And we can talk about the specifics, the difficulties, the things that we need to consider when we're making healthcare decisions. Of course, it's critical for that healthcare agent to have as much knowledge about the patient's desires, wishes as they can so that they're able to speak very accurately for the patient.
So who might you choose to be your healthcare agent? Would it be a relative or a physician?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Most commonly, I think people are choosing a relative, a spouse, an adult child. Most states specifically exclude a physician as being the healthcare agent because of concerns for conflict of interest and that kind of thing. So, but generally, it's going to be a close family member or it may be a close friend.
Now, Wish 2 discusses life support, which can be anything from a blood transfusion right through to ventilation and intensive care. Dr. Tanzian, these decisions around these things can vary substantially from one person mm-hmm. to another. So what creates those differences? Why do we see the world so differently? And how can we better understand each other?
I think that it's just become so complicated because of the type of technology that we have, that even to predict what you would or wouldn't want in a future state can be difficult. So people try to anticipate what it would be like to live on a ventilator if they were paralyzed, and they don't realize that people change their mind if they're in that state and realize, hey, if it's between being alive and on the ventilator or dead, I think I'd rather stay living. Where it gets difficult is when you're in a state where the person can't tell you anymore what they want, and it's clear that that condition is irreversible. You know, to me, the living will, the value of the living will is to identify what people definitely don't want. So if you have somebody who's so clear, I would never want to be kept alive in a vegetative state on any life support, that's helpful information to have. It's less helpful when the situation is less clear about the prognosis of the patient or, you know, what state they're actually in. Mm.
Now, many people fear the end of life because of the potential for suffering, the loss of dignity, or the loss of control, or increasing dependence on others. Dr. Harden, because of this, some people believe that they have the right to hasten death, while others don't consider it a moral option at all. But it's not so black and white, is it?
Well, that's correct. People disagree pretty dramatically about the appropriateness of that. And most of those involved in palliative care, end-of-life care, strongly emphasize that that very good palliative hospice care can really minimize, if not eliminate, the desire for euthanasia or for a patient directly requesting the end of their life. But people disagree with that, and it's not bounded strictly by religious belief, and there are certainly Christians who feel it's okay, whereas I think most would say that directly causing a patient's death with the intent of alleviating suffering is really not permissible.
Mm. And I think we take the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm, and it's quite hard to imagine being in that situation.
It's difficult.
Dr. Tarzian, euthanasia can be described as active or passive. Tell us the difference between those.
So passive euthanasia is really when someone is dying and you're either taking away treatments that are prolonging their life. A lot of people make the mistake of thinking that giving morphine or a drug like that if someone's dying is a form of euthanasia. Actually, if you're giving it in the way that's just treating their symptoms like pain or shortness of breath, it doesn't actually hasten death in most cases. So active euthanasia is when you really are doing something that has the intent of hastening the person's death directly. So giving a drug. We don't consider taking away machines like a ventilator as a form of active euthanasia because it's considered that the disease is what's causing the person to die, not the removal of that life support.
Dr. Harden, what alternatives can be offered to people whose quality of life is deteriorating and they don't want to suffer for long? But euthanasia is not an option.
Well, yes, I think there, at least speaking from the medical side of things, it's obviously close attention to symptoms, relieving pain, relieving breathlessness, relieving anxiety. But perhaps in some ways even more important is the personal connection between the healthcare team, the physician, the nurse, and the patient, emphasizing the importance for the patient's family, the patient's loved ones, friends to be closely involved. And that's not easy. It's not easy for the patient, and it's not easy for those with them. But I think attention to all of that is really critical to alleviating that patient's suffering, both their existential suffering as well as their physical suffering.
And as you say, symptom control really improves quality of life, or
yes,
if it's not done, right, will change quality of life.
And if I could just add, too, on the issue of passive euthanasia, you know, people do get concerned about pain relief. Does that shorten? It may be that better attention to relieving symptoms actually extends life. And there have been a couple of recent studies that have shown that very effective hospice palliative care, patients actually live longer than if they don't get good palliative care.
This is a sensitive subject that's not as clear as it may first seem. And in the next segment, we'll see a great tool to help start the conversation. But before we go to break, let's take a look at how Jesus engaged in end-of-life planning for himself. We don't like to think about the inevitability of death until we're forced to. And then we begin to prepare. We put our affairs in order, make our plans, and draw our loved ones close. At the age of 12, Jesus learned that he had been born to die for you and me. His last 3 years were filled with healing the sick, raising the dead, freeing the bound, preaching to all who would listen, and discipling his followers. As the final Passover drew near, he drew them closer, warning them and preparing them for his demise. In response, Mary Magdalene spent her life savings on some precious perfume and embalmed his living body. He accepted her tribute of love and gratitude. In the upper room, he established a memorial to his death, and in Gethsemane, he craved the company of those he loved. He agonized over the decision before him. It took him all his strength, but he overcame and submitted his life to God, his Father. Then he went forward to face his future. He bore his suffering with dignity. There was no anger, hatred, or bitterness, just calm acceptance. As the nails pierced his flesh, he forgave the soldiers who drove them. And then as he hung on those nails, he commissioned John to care for his only dependent, Mary, his mother. Then he cried out in triumph, announcing, "Mission accomplished, a perfect life, a perfect death for you and me."
As for me, I call to God and the Lord saves me. Evening, morning, and noon I cry out in distress, and he hears my voice.
Now I'm ready for your questions. Someone called and said, human biosolids are being spread over the fields here in Virginia as fertilizer for soy and veggies. Then, after harvest, the cattle eat the remainder of the crop down to the ground. How much of excreted pharmaceuticals are getting into the food chain? Well, by law, the spray needs to be ploughed into the ground within 48 hours of spraying, and then no animals can graze on that land for at least a month. No root crops can be grown for 3 years because they tend to pull these things into their crop. Now, the pathogens are allegedly killed by pre-treatment, And then once they're on the field by sunlight, the local temperature, microbes in the soil, and simply by the passage of time. Now, of course, people are concerned that there might be heavy metals, industrial chemicals, dioxins, PCBs, radioisotopes, pharmaceuticals, and hormones that can get into the soil from humans. But apparently the levels are very low. Now, there's debate amongst experts about the relative safety of biosolids in general. This is a new farming practice and time will no doubt tell, but in the meantime, the Environmental Protection Agency is regulating this practice. So we'll see. Janet called and said, I'm diabetic and reading nutrition labels. That's great, Janet. Keep reading them. She asks, how much is 1 gram of sugar? 1 gram is equivalent to 1/4 of a teaspoon. So 4 grams of sugar is in 1 teaspoon. Another caller asked, what happens to your kidneys when you drink alcohol? Well, as you know, alcohol has more of an effect on the liver, but in the kidneys, it causes a diuresis or a loss of fluid. So it makes the kidneys work overtime, and it can change the body's equilibrium of fluid, acids, and salts. But remember your liver. If you have more questions, please let me know. The number's 855-400-HEALTHY. That's 855-400-4325. And to text your questions, it's 301-960-5144. Don't forget to like us on Facebook. Our Facebook page is a great way to post your questions, and I can give you the answers straight back. Onions are the third most consumed vegetable in the United States. They are so versatile, great for breakfast, casseroles, barbecues, and even holiday dinners. They give flavour, colour, and texture to a wide variety of dishes and cuisines. 87% of the United States onion crop are yellow. They're a great, reliable standby for cooking almost anything. 8% of the crops are red onions, and with their wonderful flavour and colour, it's a good choice for roasting or for fresh. White onions make up just 5% of the US onion crop, and they're used in salads, white sauces, and they're the traditional onion for classical Mexican cuisine. And because they're one of the top 10 antioxidant veggies, be sure to have some most days. Bon appetit! Now it's time to rejoin the discussion with Anita Tarzian and Dr. Steve Harden. We'll start with a helpful icebreaker. Anita, you've brought an interesting card game here. Tell us about it.
Yes. Now, I think know that it's hard to bring up the topic of end of life. People are uncomfortable. They don't know how to, they think it's inappropriate to talk about. So this was a card game that was developed by the CODA Alliance out in California, which is a nonprofit that had a task of developing a way to introduce end of life care planning to, I think it was a retirement community. And so
how does it work?
You basically have a card deck, and on each card is a wish that the person is supposed to sort in a way that would prioritize what are the top 10 things that would be important to them at the end of their life. It's really a way of educating other family members or friends what's important to you, helping you get clarity on what's important to you, and starting a conversation.
Mm. So, because it can be very difficult to start a conversation sometimes. The person who's going through the illness doesn't want to talk about it. It's admitting something, or they think that they might give up if they do
sure.
it. So this seems to me a great way and kind of a non-invasive way to start that conversation.
And it's really a gift. I always think of it as a gift to your family members. If you can open up that conversation, then you avoid that scenario in the crisis moment when they're trying to make decisions and they really don't feel like they know what you would have wanted.
Hmm. Oh, that's a great little resource.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Now, let's say that a loved one has a lethal accident, they're on life support, and then they are declared brain dead. And this is a common scenario around intensive care units. Dr. Harden, what is brain death? How was that diagnosed?
Well, brain death is a comparatively recent sort of definition for death, really in the last 40 years or so. And it really reflects the fact that medical technology allows us to keep parts of the body, the lungs, the heart, et cetera, going. And so it's tougher to tell when somebody's died. So brain death, or whole brain death, has really become the legal and clinical definition of death. And it refers to sort of all functions of the brain, both higher brain, that is my ability to think, to speak, to interact, as well as brainstem reflexes, things that drive my breathing.
Now, Dr. Tazian, what can help a family come to that decision to withdraw life support?
Well, I think it's really the question of considering the person that they love who's dying, the medical facts. We always say good ethics starts with good facts, so you want to have reassurance, for example, that if they've done tests of brain death, then it's really not a question of withdrawing life support. The decision has already been made. If they haven't reached where the person is brain dead, then you consider, you know, can they recover from this? If not, you know, did they leave wishes in the form of a living will? Are they in one of those conditions? If they're considered to be in a terminal condition and they had filled out a living will saying, I don't want to be kept alive on life support, then the decision has really been made by the individual. And really reminding people that they're not making a decision to, people say, pull the plug on their loved one, but really doing what would be consistent with their wishes, and treating them with love and dignity as we all would want to be treated at the end of life.
So you're actually honoring your loved one's
mm-hmm.
request,
exactly.
so to speak.
Yeah.
Dr. Harden, is it important to continue care until all the family members are ready to accept that?
Yes, that can be a very difficult situation because both legally and clinically, when a patient has been declared brain dead, they are dead. On the other hand, when they're in the ICU, they're brain dead, but they're still on a ventilator, emotionally it can be very difficult to sort of come to terms with that. And it's important for the team caring for that patient and really now caring for the family to take all of that into account. And at times you will sort of kind of continue, in a sense, organ support for a period of time to help the family and loved ones kind of come to terms with what's really happened.
Now, Dr. Tazian, what factors might the family need to consider before making that decision together?
Well, again, if we're talking about, let's say they're not declared brain dead, but they're on life support and you're making the decision whether to withdraw life support, again, if that person were in the room telling you, what would they want? That would be an important consideration. And the other would be, you know, is this reversible? Is there, has everything been done that can be done to change the course of events? And if it's just a question of the person's dying, this is the problem with our technology, is sometimes the healthcare staff doesn't even know when they can declare a person to be dying, because if you can keep people alive on ventilators, on dialysis, on these more invasive technologies, it blurs the line between when you're actually considered dying from some kind of progressive illness. So getting the facts, I think. And also, there are ethics consultants in most hospitals in the U.S. that are trained to help people in these kind of situations. So just getting some resources, asking for some support if you feel like the choices are really overwhelming and you want some backup.
Yes, because I can think of patients I've cared for as an OBGYN who perhaps have cancer and then they suddenly have a heart attack. And that can be an unexpected thing. And I'm sure you, Dr. Harden, you've been in this situation. And that can be very difficult to work through in the acute situation.
That's very, very correct. And certainly speaking now as a physician, it's, first of all, important for me to sort of have the facts together. What is the diagnosis? What is the prognosis? What are the realistic options? And to be able to work that through in my own mind. And then to be able to discuss that with the patient's family, and try to gauge what that patient does or does not want. And certainly if the disease is reversible or there's a reasonable chance for some good recovery, then I'm going to push that direction. But when it becomes clear that there is no reasonable chance for meaningful recovery, then focusing particularly on comfort and supportive care is really of paramount importance.
It may be difficult to envisage, but giving the gift of life, even in death, is possible with organ donation. Let's ask our experts about that in the next segment. And Cliff's story concludes right after the break. Stand by.
Thank you.
And we're back. If you have any health questions, then leave your question for us on 855-400-HEALTHY if you're calling from the US. If you're calling from overseas or you want to text your question, the number's 301-960-5144. Or you can post your question to the Go Healthy for Good Facebook page. In the first part of Clifford Goldstein's story, his aging father was challenged by illness. In an effort to die with dignity and to limit suffering, his father decided to take his own life, and his wife did not want to live without him. How does Cliff deal with this and come to terms with it?
Where you draw the line on these things? You know, I read some things about euthanasia and about people who were very, very sick and didn't expect to get better and who wanted to die. And then they got better. Then they were cured. Then they got better. And suddenly they were so glad they didn't die. So I think we have to be careful. I when it comes to terms of salvation and my father, he was not a believer in Jesus, not that I know of. But I'm probably more concerned about my father's eternal destiny, not from how he died, but more from how he lived. Okay, I'm not the death thing. I just, you know, that's the least of my worries in terms of that. But I'm thankful that I know that God is just. When I look at the death of Jesus on the cross, that's what God is like. That's what I can, you know, I trust. And I, you know, the Bible has a teaching about the millennium. And our understanding of it is we have 1,000 years in heaven. And it's interesting, if you study the theology, from our understanding, not one person faces any kind of final judgment, any kind of final condemnation or judgment by God, till after the 1,000 years. And with my understanding of theodicy, which is kind of a fancy theological term, but it talks about the goodness of God in the face of evil. How could be God all good, all loving, all powerful, and there be such suffering? And a theodicy is an attempt to answer this. And in my understanding of theodicy, I find it very interesting that I believe not until after this 1,000 years, when I believe every question will be answered, And we can see the justice and goodness and fairness of God. Only after that's done will there be this final punishment. Now, again, I can't be too dogmatic about projecting eschatological things at which we don't have that much information on. But it sure makes sense. And it sure has made me feel better about, you know, dealing with the thing with my father. But the whole question of quality of life, what point do you, I mean, do you, you know, shoot somebody or let them shoot themselves, or do you stop giving them care? You know, you stop giving them the medication they need, or you unplug them. I mean, is that a distinction without a difference? You know, you pull the plug and, or you just stop giving them the medication that will keep them alive. And those are all, you know, all difficult things. And you know, and I think my father, I don't think there's any real resolution here in the sense of whether it was right or wrong, but I just think it's just an example of how difficult some of these things are. You know, there was a Christian philosopher named Soren Kierkegaard, and he once said, every man is an exception. Every person is an exception, which means every situation in their life is an exception. Every situation is unique. And so, who are we to judge? Sure, we believe in the Ten Commandments, these overarching principles that we do not compromise on and so forth. But how you understand to apply them, even to apply them in an uncompromising way, is not always so clear, cut, dry, and simple. So I have closure with my father, I guess as much as you can with something like this. But in the end, though, the ultimate peace, the ultimate thing comes from my trust in the goodness and mercy of our God.
We can be so grateful that we have a merciful judge in Jesus. Many people are on a waiting list for organ donation, whether it be to restore sight or to prolong life. I asked Dr. Harden whether ticking the boxes on my driver's license application is sufficient to ensure my organs are donated.
Theoretically, it should be. In actual practice, that may vary from state to state. And even when a person is indicated on their driver's license that they do wish to donate organs, close family members object, it may be more difficult. Advance directives were not originally designed to convey that information, but that can be a useful device for a person to be very clear about, yes, I wish to donate whatever organs might be usable. So I think it can be a helpful approach.
And Dr. Tarzian, which organs can people donate?
Well, there's living donation, and then there's cadaveric donation. So if you're declared brain dead, they can take organs from the body, so the heart, liver, lung, there are kidneys. You can do intestines, pancreas, corneas, blood vessels. They've really expanded the list of things that can be used.
And there's even faces now, aren't there?
And face transplants. Mm. And there's also a concept in, living related, of chain donations, where people will donate a kidney who are living. And then it creates a chain where you expand the options for people who are on the wait list. So clearly there's more people on the wait list than there are available organs. So there is always this question of how do we get more organs available in the system, by having people agree to be organ donors if they were in an accident and, you know, didn't survive, or even living-related donation.
And is it possible to be selective about what organs you might want to donate in the event of your death?
You can. You could specify. I mean, that's not typically what's done. Usually it's, I want to be an organ donor or not. And it's more common that you specify when you're a living donor, so that you'll, you know, you can give, I think it's lung, liver, not as common, kidney, very common. But I'm sure that there are provisions for any type of restrictions on organ donation if you wanted to fill out more information in your advance directive on what was okay or not okay with you.
Sure. Now, making the decision to withdraw life support can be difficult for families, but Dr. Harden, once that decision is made, is there much delay if organ donation is part of the picture? Is there much delay in arranging the organ donation? Like, will it prolong that difficult time?
Yes, that is a difficult process. And ideally, if you're going to have the best chances for a salvageable transplant organ, those organs need to be obtained as rapidly as possible after death. However, the sort of end stage care of that patient and the declaration of death, that needs to be kept strictly separate from the decisions that are made for transplant. And that's really for this potential conflict of interest, though, so that the team that might be doing a transplant is different from the team that's actually caring for the patient.
So, Dr. Tarzian, mm-hmm. Who is able to make that decision about organ donation? Does the person themselves have to have done an advance directive, or can the family make that decision?
Family, it depends on the state. So in general, the family can make the decision. And if the person has signed, let's say, on their license, depending on what state you're in, that can even trump the family. In practice, in a crisis where family are grieving, it's typically the practice that the healthcare team will go with the family if they say, no, we don't want to give up the organs. But depending on the state and the law, they have the right to say, no, this person wanted their organs donated, so we'll take the organs and honor their wishes. So it really kind of depends on the state and the local team. Obviously, the organ transplant services don't want there to be ripple effects of people thinking that you're taking organs when they didn't want you to take organs. So they would prefer this to be voluntary and to have people be supported and not traumatized during the process. So they're very good at doing that. And if you go to the United Network for Organ Sharing website, you can see pictures of people that are on the wait list, people that have given permission to and have their pictures posted who have received organs. So it's really an amazing thing that our technology has created all of these, saved lives based on really basically other people's grief and tragedy. So kind of bringing something positive out of that sadness.
Mm. Absolutely. Dr. Harden, if organs are donated, when is death actually declared?
Well, those are two separate events, and death is declared if it's a brain death. There are a number of clinical tests that are done to make that determination. And while there's good agreement about how that's done, states vary a little bit on sort of the procedures. Some states, in fact, require two physicians to make the determination of brain death. Cardiac death, death by sort of failure of the heart, often occurs when the family patient team have decided to withdraw treatment and really allow death to occur. So those are sort of separate processes.
Dr. Tarzian, just the last question. Can there be meaning and purpose even at the end of life?
Oh, this is what makes us human, is the fact that we die and we have to figure out what that means, that we're here for the time that we're here. And why do some people get to live to be 100 and other people live to be 2 weeks old? And the sense and meaning that we make out of our own mortality and our experiences with loved ones, I think, makes us who we are and gives us so much richness and meaning. And so I think supporting people through that process is really an obligation of healthcare providers, not just to cure, but also to be there with patients and families through to the end. I think it's tremendously meaningful. And if it's done well, it has this ability to impact people in a positive way. And if it's done poorly, I think that trauma can really carry with it for years, unfortunately. So,
thank you so much for being on the show today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
It's been great. And thank you, Dr. Harden. It's been wonderful having you.
Thank you.
A friend of mine and her husband completed their five wishes documents and discussed them together. They were both well at the time. They were a little older. Little did they know that within a few months, he would die unexpectedly. Knowing his wishes made the journey just a wee bit easier for her. Have you considered creating a living will? Perhaps this program has got you thinking. Don't leave it there. You could download the five wishes document and complete it. Appoint a healthcare agent and be clear as to what you would want in those various circumstances. And remember those on the waiting list for organs. In death, you may be able to give life to another person. Be sure to discuss this with your family and document it on your driver's license. And when all is said and done, will you be able to stand before the judge because you know him and he knows you? Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you next time.